This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
A year ago today, Kabul fell to the Taliban before anyone expected.
It felt as though the circus was moving on, that the international community was bored, perhaps had given up on a war that they could not win.
12 months after that chaos, we find out how people on the plains of central Afghanistan have fared since the Taliban takeover. Also today, wildlife detectives turned to high tech in Asia using AI to combat tiger poachers.
Tiger stripes are literally like human fingerprints. They're unique.
Plus, author Salman Rushdie's problems began when Iran's leader called for his death decades ago. After last week's attack on Rushdie, questions about the assailant's connections.
Whether this person was a lone wolf, essentially, or if this was a paid job by the Islamic Republic.
Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for starting your week with us. In August of last year, the United States was poised to leave Afghanistan. An orderly troop withdrawal was planned and aimed to be completed by the end of the month. The Afghan government would then need to stand on its own. That was the plan. On the morning of this day last year, August 15th, the Afghan capital, Kabul, was quiet, but Taliban fighters had the city surrounded.
Our leadership have instructed our forces to remain at the gate of the Kabul, not to enter the city.
A Taliban spokesman was on the phone with the BBC.
We are awaiting a peaceful transfer of power.
By late morning, Taliban negotiators were in the presidential palace to begin that transfer of power. And then, as Kabul residents and foreign journalists looked on, armed Taliban fighters entered the city.
Then we heard gunshots. Then smoke started burning from U.S. government buildings as they started burning documents. And at that point, many, many more helicopters were put in the air.
Reporter Charlotte Bellis with Al Jazeera there. Kabul's airport quickly became ground zero for a scramble to evacuate. Some Afghans got there more quickly than others, as reported by India's The World Is One News.
It has now been confirmed by the Afghan press, citing their sources, that President Ashraf Ghani has left the country.
And with that, the Taliban were in total control. The speedy collapse of Afghanistan's government took Western leaders by surprise. In the U.S., Secretary of State Antony Blinken went on CNN and tried to avoid comparisons with another U.S. withdrawal 5 decades earlier.
This is not Saigon. We went to Afghanistan 20 years ago with one mission. And that mission was to deal with the folks who attacked us on 9/11. And we have succeeded in that mission.
By nightfall on August 15th last year, the Taliban had control of Kabul and most of Afghanistan. So much has changed since then. Many Afghans fled and are living in exile. Others stayed but remain in hiding, afraid of their new government. Food insecurity is a big worry. The economy is in shambles. And the Taliban government has yet to be officially recognized by the international community. To help us understand how things have changed, we're going to focus now on one province in Afghanistan. The World's Shirin Jafari spoke with residents of Bamiyan in central Afghanistan and brings us their story.
Bamiyan was thrown into the global spotlight in 2001. It's where the Taliban carried out one of its most spectacular bombings. The target was two giant 6th-century statues carved into cliffs. The Taliban considered them un-Islamic and ordered them destroyed. It took weeks of planning. Taliban fighters forced the residents in the area to help with planting the explosives inside the statues. Many were against the destruction of historical heritage, but they had no choice.
We heard the radio.
Laiq Ahmadi was a child when the statues were blown up. His family was huddled around the radio when they got the news. He says they were devastated. It seemed like an ominous sign of more destruction and mayhem to come. And yes, for the next two decades, the Taliban fought against the U.S. in Afghanistan. Relentless conflict left much of the country in ruins. But the U.S. also had nation-building ambitions, and its effects could be felt in Bamiyan. Ahmadi was deeply moved by the destruction of the statues. He went on to study archaeology in Kabul, and in 2011, he came back home to start a brand new archaeology department at the University of Bamiyan. He says initially he had to do a lot of things by himself, writing up curriculums, teaching, and doing the admin work. It was a lot, but it was worth it, he says. The war was raging across the country, and it was devastating for many Afghans. But in Bamiyan, there were glimmers of hope, too. Bamiyan is home to the Hazara ethnic group in Afghanistan. They have historically been sidelined and persecuted. Human rights organizations have documented Taliban's mass atrocities against them. Ali Fuladwan's family experienced this discrimination firsthand. He says before the U.S. invasion, it was rare for Hazaras in Bamiyan to have access to education. In previous generations, out of 100 or 200 households, maybe one person would have the opportunity to go to school, he tells me. That changed after Taliban fell. Fuladwan and his sisters were the first in his family to get an education. His school had no chairs, he remembers, so he would bring a mat from home to sit on. This was a huge change for us, he says. For the first time, Hazara families in Bamiyan were sending their children to school, and not just the boys, girls too. Fuladwan did so well, he was awarded a scholarship to go to medical school in Turkey. It was like a dream, he says. How could a Hazara be given a scholarship to study medicine abroad? I couldn't believe it. Fuladwan had planned to go back to Afghanistan to work in a clinic, but now he doesn't feel safe. Until last summer, tourism was also thriving in Bamiyan. 30-year-old Abdullah Anwari was an assistant to the governor of the province. He also used to lead tours there. Foreign tourists came to visit, he says, from Europe, China, and the US. He describes Bamiyan as the perfect tourism spot in Afghanistan. It has natural beauty and historical sites. Anwari managed cultural festivals, ski competitions, and marathons. But these days, Anwari is in hiding. Since they took power, the Taliban have been targeting those who worked in the previous government. They've cracked down on ethnic minorities. All that worries Anwari, a Hazara. So he moves from one location to another, he says, with his family. I'm most worried about my children, he says. One is 3, another one is 5 years old. This life is hard for them. With no job, Anwari has relied on relatives for food, but he doesn't know how much longer he can go on like this. The new Taliban government appointed Mullah Abdullah Sarhadi as governor of Bamiyan, the same person who oversaw the destruction of the Buddha statues in 2001. Every day, things get worse and worse, Anwari says. Every day, there is more oppression, more injustice. The Taliban also recently announced new plans to construct a bazaar near the remains of the Buddha statues. That infuriated many residents who say the group is set on destroying their culture and identity. Anwari and others tell me it feels like after 20 years, things in Bamiyan are back to where they started. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
After waiting for almost a week, the results of Kenya's presidential election were announced earlier today. William Ruto won the election by the thinnest of margins. Just before his name was announced, things got tense when fighting broke out at the National Electoral Tallying Center in Nairobi. 4 of 7 election commissioners would not verify the results. I'm joined by the world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi in Nairobi. Halima, let's start with the results. Tell us about William Ruto.
Well, William Ruto is currently Kenya's deputy president. He has been in office for the past 10 years, so he's no newbie to politics by any means. That said, he's really cast himself in this election as a champion of the common Kenyan, and he cited his humble roots and really cast his opponents as people belonging to political dynasties, and it seems like that message has really resonated with Kenyan voters. But it was a close race. He won 50.49% of the vote, and the runner-up, Raila Odinga, won 48.85%. So that's a difference of about 200,000 votes.
Yes, so really close. Reports of fighting at the last minute before the announcement of Ruto's victory at the tallying center. That was kind of disturbing. What happened?
It was very chaotic, and that was surprising thing because the day started off quite calm. Throughout the day at the tallying center, there was choral music and dancing, so the atmosphere was very lively. And then midway through the day, fighting broke out when it appeared that election officials were starting to arrive. And then about 20 minutes later, the head of the Electoral Commission, Wafula Chebukati, returned, and this is what he said.
We have staff who have been arbitrarily arrested for no reasons. We don't know where they are.
It's a little hard to hear, but what he's saying is that he's had staff who have been arbitrarily arrested and he doesn't know where they are, but that they have a constitutional duty to perform and announce the results of this election. He also said that there have been electoral commissioners who have been injured and that there have been others who have been harassed. But after saying all of that, he went on to announce that William Ruto had won this election.
So, Halima, you are safe. Can you help us understand why these tensions right at the last minute?
I am safe, thank you, and I'm still currently at the National Tallying Center. Most people have left now, but it's unclear what was causing these tensions. I mean, there were some tensions over the weekend between representatives of the political parties as the tallying was still going on and as the counting of the votes was still going on. And then today there were reports of a disagreement within the Electoral Commission. And then also one of the political agents of Raila Odinga, who was that runner-up presidential candidate, criticized the Electoral Commission and alleged that the commission had been hacked and that there was general electoral misconduct.
Is there any merit to those claims?
They still have not offered evidence to back up those claims. And interestingly, there have been many criticisms against Kenya's electoral body in past elections, but this time was a bit different. Electoral observers had actually been commending the commission for its transparency during this election. One thing that really stood out is that the commission had uploaded the results pictures from polling station counts so that everyone, including politicians, including the general public, could go online and download those pictures and do their own calculations, which was what was happening. But as one expert recently told me, Kenyans are just as litigious as Americans, and candidates do have the right to petition the presidential results in the Supreme Court within the next 7 days. But in the meantime, people are calling for peace and for calm and are encouraging political leaders not to incite issues in the public.
So some claims of fraud, but commendation for the Electoral Commission there, and now an announced winner, William Ruto. So what's the current atmosphere like?
Well, now we're waiting to see. Had you asked me that yesterday, I would have said that generally things have been calm and relatively peaceful. I mean, of course, in the past, there are always concerns about violence in the back of people's minds because of previous elections. And no one can forget how in 2007, post-election violence led to more than 1,000 people dying. But I'll be closely following the situation. And a lot of people have gone up country. They closed their businesses early today because they just don't want to be out on the streets in case there are any issues.
The world's Halima Gikandi in Nairobi with the results of the Kenyan presidential election. Thank you for the latest, Halima.
Thank you, Marco.
Just ahead, how the attack on author Salman Rushdie is being seen inside Iran. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Author Salman Rushdie continues to recover following an attack on his life last week. A 24-year-old man charged at and then stabbed Rushdie while the author was speaking on the topic of freedom of speech. Rushdie's troubles first began back in 1989. That's when Iran's former supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, called for his death after the publication of Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses. We were wondering how last week's incident is being seen in Iran. We're joined by Holly Digress to find out. She's a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Middle East programs in Washington. What has been reaction in Iran, Holly, about the attack on Rushdie? Maybe you can talk first about what the government is saying.
There's two essentially narratives that are coming out of Tehran. One is that hardliners are celebrating the assassination attempt on Salman Rushdie. They have been saying that the devil's eye has been blinded, that the devil is on his way to hell in some of the headlines. We've also heard this different narrative from more reformist line papers that this is not the work of anybody affiliated with Iran, but rather this is something as a means to undermine the nuclear negotiations in Vienna, that maybe they're alluding to maybe Israel being some behind the assassination attempt.
What about the wider public? Has there been a reaction by Iranians, as far as we can tell?
Well, there's certainly been a condemnation by some Iranians who view that this was a horrific incident and that Rushdie has been an advocate of freedom of speech. But we've also seen that pro-Islamic Republic elements alleged that they had ties or a relationship, at least online and on WhatsApp, with the suspect, only to delete the tweet afterwards because it was garnering too much attention.
So the assailant who attacked Rushdie is under investigation for foreign connections. Is that what the investigation is diving into, or is there more?
Well, right now, we don't know enough. There's certainly evidence that he does have this pro-Islamic Republic leanings. I think that authorities here in the United States are trying to find out is whether he was actually paid to do that, that this was not a operation by Iran's intelligence apparatus.
So let's step back for a moment to what started all of this. What's kind of the legacy of the fatwa that called for Rushdie's death in 1989 following the publication of his book, The Satanic Verses?
When the book had been published in 1989, it hadn't been on the radar of the Islamic Republic. It actually only caught the attention of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini months after the fact that many countries in the Muslim world were protesting against the book. And in many ways, he saw this as an opportunity. One, because there were a lot of issues festering at home. The country was in a war with Iraq, and there were many failures as a nascent Islamic Republic. And so turning his focus on Satanic Verses was in many ways a useful tool, or something that essentially distracted from problems at home.
I mean, the attack on Rushdie last Friday was such a surprise and stunning and took us all back to 1989. Why have we not heard more about this decades-old decree in Iran in the years since it was first made, and those first couple of years where it was really kind of on everyone's mind?
For the longest time, it seemed as though that it was the story of the past. Eventually, Salman Rushdie came out of hiding. He lived a somewhat normal life, no longer with security overhead. From what I've read of him, he seemed to think that it was something that was no longer to be a focus of worry in his life. This fatwa was technically never revoked by Ayatollah Khomeini, and it was something that was later brought up by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who actually had made mention of it over the decades. We've heard him say in the early 1990s that the fatwa was like an arrow that had not made its target and that it eventually would someday. In the early 2000s, the Supreme Leader make reference to the fatwa that it was still in place. And so we have a history of the highest levels of the Islamic Republic actually making reference to this fatwa still being in place, and therefore meaning that the killing of Salman Rushdie would be a possibility.
Holly Digress is a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Middle East program. She's been speaking with us from Washington. Holly, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
A century ago, from Siberia to Indonesia, there were some 100,000 wild tigers roaming the Asian continent. Today, there are fewer than 5,000. It is illegal to kill them, but poaching is still a big problem across Asia, even though these tigers face extinction. The World's Patrick Wynn reports that conservationists are stepping up, ready to fight back with artificial intelligence.
No two tigers have the same stripes. Each animal has a different pattern of black streaks on orange fur.
Tiger stripes are literally like human fingerprints. They're unique.
Debbie Banks is with the UK-based nonprofit Environmental Investigation Agency. Just as homicide detectives rely on human fingerprints, wildlife detectives can use tiger stripes in their work. They can potentially figure out the origins of a tiger skin seized from criminals, finding out if it came from a dodgy zoo or the wild, to help them identify and punish whoever killed the tiger. But it's really hard.
We have to manually cross-reference those new images against our own little database.
Their database includes photos of tigers in Chinese circuses, tigers in people's backyards in Texas, and footage of tigers in the wild. That's a tigress in Sumatra, Indonesia, caught roaring on a camera trap in the forest. She is in the database. Debbie Banks' team also collects photos of tiger pelts.
That could be like actual entire tiger skins, skins that have been turned into rugs or taxidermy specimens, or even like entire carcasses of tigers.
Now imagine staring at a crime scene photo of a tiger skin and trying to match its stripe pattern with zillions of photos. It's quite a task for human eyeballs. So this summer, the Environmental Investigation Agency started working with the British government on a better technique. The UK's Alan Turing Institute, which develops artificial intelligence, is creating software to sift through all that imagery and find matches.
There's a lot of potential to identify tigers from one part of the world ending up for sale in another.
If a tiger from a zoo in Thailand is killed and its skin ends up in China, this AI might spot it, and investigators could notify police. That's the goal. But the software will only work if the database has a lot of photos. Banks wants the public to send any original tiger photos to the Environmental Investigation Agency. There's a form on their website. In the meantime, wild tigers are helping out in their own way. This huge tiger walked past a camera trap in Siberia just a few months ago. And though he doesn't know it, he's now in the database too. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. What's in the documents? That is the big guessing game about what the FBI uncovered at Mar-a-Lago. The speculation has some foreign leaders feeling a little nervous.
Because those documents could be the verbatim transcripts of phone calls or meetings he had with them, with those foreign heads of state.
And Protest Seoul from Sudan, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Today marks 1 year since the abrupt and chaotic fall of the Afghan capital, Kabul. It wasn't that people thought a Taliban takeover was impossible. It was how fast it happened. Nilufar Hedayat is a reporter and host of the podcast Kabul Falling. Her project is a tightly woven picture of a sprawling disaster in those final days of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Nilufar, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Your project, Kabul Falling, follows different Afghans from lots of different parts of society. The way their accounts are layered on top of one another really gives you this intense understanding of how in a matter of hours Kabul fell and the entire city became frantic. People are scrambling to find their family, get to the airport, pack their bags. One of those people is Fatima Faizi. Who is she?
I mean, Fatima's one of the lucky ones because she had contacts outside of Afghanistan and was able to contact the New York Times, was able to help her leave as quickly as possible. And she mentions taking a photo of the last time she saw her living room.
I took a picture. I just wanted to remember how everything was intact. I didn't know when I'm going to come back, but nothing was touched in my living room. Everything was the same way that it used to be.
And as a refugee myself, I fled Afghanistan as a young person, as a child. in 1994 when the Taliban first came in. I know what she was doing in that moment. She was capturing a moment that was stillness and time that she would never be able to get back.
Really, really hard to imagine if you're not there. So there's a whole plane that's chartered for New York Times reporters and staff, but Fatima and some others, they miss it. So they camp out in the hot sun at the airport. Her elderly father is there. He's got no water and he's in a bad way. He's wilting. And then this patrol of Marines walks by. Tell us about that moment.
It was one of the moments in Fatima's story that I had to do a mental somersault, because we are there, we are unwelcome, we do bad things, we try our best, but the outcome is never one that the Afghan people want.
I was like screaming for 20 minutes. I was literally yelling, "Hey, my name is Fatima, and this group, we work for the New York Times, please bring me some water."
And in the moment of kindness that Fatima experiences, with just a bottle of water being handed to her by one of the American forces, I just had to remember humanity and goodness exist everywhere.
Tiny moments of humanity. There's one Marine who actually joins her family and they weep together.
The day on 15th of August 2021 ripped apart any assumption that there are good guys and bad guys and winners and losers and us and them. And the moment when a Marine, I don't think Fatima ever got to thank him, which is very tough for her, I'm sure. But the moment when he became and did the thing we all wish we would, it blurs all the lines between us and them. A moment can call you to do so many things, but definitely in the heat of the day, with the pressures and the sounds of the Taliban at the front gates, for goodness sake, that there were these little patches of humanity.
I mean, you said this earlier, Fatima Faizi is one of the lucky ones. She had the phone numbers for top U.S. officials, ambassadors, even had the backing of the New York Times and all those contacts, but she's just sort of stranded. What do you think that says?
It felt as though the circus was moving on, that the international community was bored, perhaps had given up on a war that they could not win. Until very recently, I don't think there has been made any systemic plan of holding the Taliban, who are the new government in Afghanistan, they are the new rulers, to holding them to account. So there's one thing to leave because you think you can't win, but there's another thing to abandon lock, stock, the people that you said you cared about. I'm finding it harder and harder to speak to my family in Afghanistan. I have an aunt who was a headmistress and now can't feed her family. And talking to her is like talking to hopelessness itself. And that's what we have done by moving so quickly and leaving as urgently as we did. The Western world has almost committed all of the people we said we wanted to help to hopelessness.
I'm speaking with reporter Niloufar Hedayat, host of the podcast Kabul Falling. Niloufar, there's another character in your podcast, an Afghan guy, Abdel. His special immigrant visa to the U.S. is being processed when Kabul falls. He had been an interpreter for the CIA. You interviewed his counterpart in the CIA, who goes by the name Phil. Tell me about Phil and Abdel's relationship.
I love this story, and I love Abdel as he tells his story about working with Phil, these two people that essentially believed in the same cause for a better Afghanistan. Phil did everything he could to try and give Abdel hope, but also the ability to leave. And these CIVs, these special visas, immigration visas, they're incredibly hard to apply for, not to mention when the country that you're applying from essentially collapses.
Abdel wasn't just a coworker. Phil calls him a brother. So he goes to this friend's safe house to hide and plan his family's escape. And this is when the well-armed Taliban literally start walking through the streets of Kabul for the first time. What happened that night with Abdel?
It's all well and good to talk about the Taliban in the abstract as the boogeyman, as the bad guy. But when they're pacing up and down the alleyways of the safe house you're in, and when they're calling your name, and when they're knocking on the door and asking if there's any man there looking a certain way, I mean, they were literally describing Abdel to the guard.
And so they say that, "Who are you?" But I was scared. My heart beats you know, very fast. My mouth's dry.
I mean, it's rule by fear, as you say, and that's what's kind of crazy about this situation with Abdul when the Taliban asked for him to come downstairs at the safe house. How'd he get out of that?
I mean, essentially, his wife managed to talk them out of it because it wasn't just once that they came, right? So they came once and his wife or his mother managed to get them away from the door and saying, no, there's no one here. But they came again days later. And you have to bear in mind, there's small children in the family. They don't have enough food. They don't have enough water. It's unbearable heat, unbearable. And the only thing separating you and the Taliban is maybe a guard and a door.
Eventually, like everyone in the story, Abdul ends up at the Kabul airport trying to escape. You describe the airport as a fortress. How did it seem that way?
It's almost medieval, the Kabul airport at that point. Different gates, Abbey Gate. But for something close to 4 or 5 days, that airport in Kabul became the center of everybody's focus in the country. It was the only way that expats, those from the United States, from the United Kingdom and the international community working in Afghanistan could leave. It's where all the diplomats had to go through. It's where the former president was reported to leave from. So it became the absolute focal point. And Abdul and Fatima and so many others that were trying to escape, who had the correct documentation, who had the correct visas and the right paperwork and recommendation letters, were unable to do so because on one hand, they had the Taliban. And on the other side of the gate, they had the United States forces. And yet people still hung on because it was the only portal, the only way that they were going to be able to leave the country.
How does this play out for Abdul?
He's forced to wade through rubbish and to stand in the heat and at moments, I mean, this is a heartbreaking scene for him.
So I tried my best and I stayed there in that ditch trying to convince one or another American for like 2 hours.
He's forced to just hold his papers over at the Marines and beg and say, please, just have a look.
Everybody was, you know, having some sort of papers in their hands. You know, true or false, God knows.
And they avert his gaze.
I mean, what do you think this kind of thing says about the whole evacuation and the U.S.'s final days in Afghanistan?
Are you asking me as an Afghan or as a journalist?
How would you like to answer that?
So perhaps I should speak from the heart because it's the honest thing to do right now. I'll say that I am rattled and deeply troubled to think that we seem to never learn from these situations. And I feel as though it is easy for me to sit here and say Afghanistan is special and different and these people matter more, but they don't, and we're not. And seeing the same episode again and again and again rerun in various places in the world where we have an interventionist mindset in the global north and we see the same results, we do not get to walk away from Afghanistan feeling proud. We have to walk away knowing that we are now tied to the outcome of Afghanistan.
Nelufar Hedayat is a reporter and the host of Kabul Falling, a podcast from Project Brazen and PRX. You can listen to the latest episode in the World podcast feed this evening. Nelufar, great to speak with you on this day. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with the World throughout August as we look back at the 20 years of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and the dramatic events that brought the Taliban back to power 1 year ago. When FBI agents came to former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence a week ago, they hauled off 11 sets of confidential or top-secret documents, records to be handled only under the strictest of conditions in secure designated locations. The revelations have led to a wave of concern among American allies, wondering if the mishandling of sensitive documents has endangered their national security. To learn more, we reached out to Tom Blanton. He directs the independent, non-governmental National Security Archive. Tom, Trump and his supporters have claimed that the former president had the power to declassify all of the documents in his possession when he was head of state, and that he did that before he left the White House. Therefore, Trump says no harm, no foul. What do you make of that explanation?
It's a fantastic argument, as if a president can declassify something just by carrying it up the stairs to the residence. That's not how declassification works. And for at least two categories of information, the president, even as commander-in-chief, doesn't have the authority to declassify. One category is nuclear weapons information. So he doesn't have the right to declassify that because that's covered by a statute. The other category is sensitive sources and methods, this SCI, sensitive compartmented information. That's codes for the intelligence community's sources, whether it's a wiretap or a human source or a satellite photo. Now, there is a famous example where Mr. Trump got a satellite photo, top secret SCI satellite photo, in one of his briefings, loved it so much that he tweeted it out on his Twitter feed. It was of an Iranian missile explosion, and Trump was kind of bragging about it and saying, ah, good luck to those Iranians. Apparently, the intelligence community went nuts over this, that here's the president unilaterally revealing their capacity to watch the Iranians, which has to be one of our biggest secrets. And he's doing it really against the law, and he got away with it.
Generally, Tom, why would foreign governments be concerned about this news, classified documents in the possession of former President Trump?
Because those documents could be the verbatim transcripts of phone calls or meetings he had with them. So, for example, the most famous transcript was Trump's phone call with Zelensky about aid to Ukraine, and Trump was holding it up. And the U.S. side released it to try to remove suspicion, to try to reduce the level of scandal in Washington. But the phone call showed Mr. Trump did exactly what the allegations were. He held up aid to Ukraine at a pivotal moment to try to get the Ukrainians to pitch in politically against his opponents.
So let's go back to the content. We don't want to speculate, obviously, but what do you know about the documents themselves?
In those 26 boxes, there were 11 series, as you say, of classified documents, and four of those were classified at the top secret SCI, or sensitive compartmented information. That's like intelligence, or it's nuclear, and that is some of the most sensitive stuff the U.S. government has. The idea of sitting in a closet in Mar-a-Lago without even a padlock until June is really astounding.
So, Tom, given what you just suggested about what could be in these documents, how is this investigation being seen by U.S. allies around the globe?
Allies around the world were really amazed at the way Trump treated the presidency as a piece of personal property, another casino he just happened to open on Pennsylvania Avenue. And now things have calmed down a lot, but the leftover, the hangover, the lingering damage from that chaos in our national security relationships is still with us, and it's still doing damage.
Well, the Washington Post has reported that Trump may have taken nuclear secrets, and the Espionage Act has been cited. I mean, again, I don't want to speculate, but is there a legitimate fear of espionage by a former president?
I think the fear is more espionage at Mar-a-Lago. Remember the famous story of the Chinese folks living in Palm Beach who each bought memberships at Mar-a-Lago and then were selling access to the club to foreigners for $1,000 here or $10,000 there. And the Secret Service at one point apprehended a couple of folks on the lawn at Mar-a-Lago who didn't have any IDs. And they said, oh, no, we've got tickets. We're going to meet President Trump. And it was a sales opportunity for these folks. So the idea you've got this unsecured club that people can join if they pay $50,000 or $100,000 and wander around, and you've got top secret documents sitting in a closet there without the security that was there when he was actually president. Yeah, that's making a lot of national security officials yell and scream about the double standards being applied to Mr. Trump.
What are you looking for next as this investigation goes forward, Tom?
The next shoe to drop will be some further description of what's actually there. The illegal taking and retaining of documents and records belonging to the government amounts to multiple felony offenses. So how are the prosecutors going to handle that? Wow, it's going to be a drama for months to come.
Tom Blanton directs the Independent Non-Governmental National Security Archive in Washington. Good to speak with you again, Tom. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The Biden administration recently ended the controversial Trump-era immigration policy known as Remain in Mexico. After an initial attempt was halted by the courts, the first migrants who were waiting in Mexico began crossing into the U.S. last week. The World's TV Saiseya has been following this and joins me now. And a warning, there will be descriptions of violence in our interview. TB, remind us briefly what this policy Remain in Mexico actually did.
Yeah, so it required asylum seekers to wait for their court hearings in Mexico on the Mexico side of the border. The Biden administration reversed that policy last week after a Supreme Court ruling. And as of last week, there were between 4 and 5,000 asylum seekers waiting in Mexico, often in dangerous conditions. So they're now being allowed to enter the U.S. slowly to wait for their court hearings safely.
So a slow entry. Do we know how long it's going to take for all of the migrants kept away from the U.S. under this policy to actually enter the country?
We know that 1 to 3 people per day have crossed from Tijuana to San Diego since Tuesday. And at that pace, it could take months to bring in all the people waiting in Tijuana and in 3 other cities in northern Mexico.
So this program, we know, has been very controversial because, as you said, it's often dangerous for those seeking asylum to be waiting in Mexico. What do we know, TB, actually happened to people while they were waiting? What were their conditions like?
Well, they became easy targets for organized crime. When people were sent back to Mexico, cartels knew exactly where they were being sent. So many were kidnapped for ransom money. I talked to Taylor Levy, an immigration attorney who says she worked with hundreds of people who have been kidnapped in Mexico as a result of this policy.
Their families have paid extortions between $5,000 to $10,000. And during those kidnappings, we hear horrific reports of beatings, sexual assault. People have, you know, their fingers amputated.
That's the most dramatic part, Marco. But lots of people also don't even have access to food, shelter, or medical care. So this decision is really a major win for asylum seekers on the border.
The Remain in Mexico policy has been going back and forth in the courts since Biden took over. Is this repeal going to stick this time?
Immigration activists are hopeful. It was a Supreme Court decision, so this looks like the final chapter in this story. But the Biden administration could be forced to restart this program in the future if that's possible.
So another major Trump-era immigration program, Title 42, that's still active. It was framed as a public health measure and stopped people at the border before they could even ask for asylum. How much does repealing Remain in Mexico do if this other policy, Title 42, is still in place?
Well, not that much. For reference, there are 4,000 or 5,000 people who are waiting on the border who are now likely to get in because Remain in Mexico is not in place anymore. But there are more than 2 million people who have been denied entry since 2020 under Title 42. So it's a much bigger policy. And it's leading to record numbers of people trying to find, you know, alternate ways to enter this country.
And is Title 42, is that program likely to also end anytime soon?
Lawyers I talked to say they don't really know. U.S. law does guarantee the right to seek asylum, and immigration lawyers see Title 42 as going against that. But more than 20 states have gone to court to keep the ruling in place. They say the country needs more time to prepare for a potential increase in migrants, and the courts have sided with them. Here is attorney Taylor Levy again.
Myself and my colleagues strongly believe that Title 42 is illegal under U.S. law. The Biden administration has been thwarted in its efforts to end Title 42 due to lawsuits by Texas, Arizona, and several other states.
But she says until we have a good system for people to seek protection on the border legally, migrants will continue risking their lives to be smuggled into this country.
Mm. The world's TB Saiseya. Thank you very much, TB.
Thank you, Marco.
Ostinato, the globe-trotting record label that released this mystical music, describes it as a sound that could have been made 6,000 years ago, 60 years, or 6 months ago. The only difference would be the instruments used. The answer, by the way, is closer to 6 months ago. The album is called Bija Power. Bija, the word describes a people and their culture that are centered on the Red Sea coastal city of Port Sudan in the country of Sudan. Bija Power is one of the few available examples of music from this eastern corner of the country. The material is reworked versions of historically ancient songs performed by a Port Sudan group, Nuri and his Dorpa Band. Nuri's work as a musician goes back to the 1990s. The story goes that Nuri was rummaging through a junkyard in Port Sudan where he found just the neck of an electric guitar. It was in pretty good shape, so when his father, a well-known musician in Sudan, gave him the traditional tambour, a four-stringed instrument, as a present, Nuri set about welding the guitar neck to the tambour, thereby creating the unique tambo guitar. That's the tambo guitar you're hearing there. Now, the Bija people have long felt alienated by the government in Khartoum, in the center of Sudan. Grievances about extraction of resources from their region were ignored for years. Although with the ouster of longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir in 2019, Bija people felt that after decades of crying out for change, their time had possibly arrived. But the return of military rule has only put those hopes on pause. Meantime, Nuri and his Dorpa band have put out this rare collection of ancient Bija music, propelled by the seductive sound of his tambo guitar. It's not just a groove. Nuri has said that right now, as the government in Khartoum continues to be led by soldiers, pumping out Bija music would be the most potent act of resistance. In fact, the title of this track, Al Amal, means hope. Music from Sudan there from Nuri and his Dorpa band. The album is called Bija Power, Electric Soul and Brass from Sudan's Red Sea Coast. And that's going to do it for us today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online all day and night at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. Thanks for being here.